Deciding whether to use the standard deduction or to itemize on your taxes has always been a bit complicated. With the new changes in tax regulations, it's even more confusing this year. We will talk with our tax specialist about how to determine what you should do. This is Darrell Conner filling in today for Larry Mueller. Good to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Our guest today is Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Mary and her husband David have been in the tax business for more than 30 years, serving individuals, consulting to tax professionals, and teaching tax seminars around the country. She is also an enrolled agent. Are you wondering which method of deductions are right for you? What questions do you have about the new tax laws? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Mary, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Mary, let's start by getting some basic definitions. What exactly is a standard deduction?
A standard deduction is a given amount of dollars that every taxpayer does not gets to reduce their income by before computing the taxation. And those numbers, there are three different levels, basically. One for the single individual, which is $12,000. One for the married couple, which is $24,000. And a different one if a single individual is considered head of household, and that's $18,000.
And what exactly is an itemized deduction?
An itemized deduction is a separate item that gets, when these items together can create a number bigger than the standard deduction to help offset their income in a larger way. The itemized deductions, the Schedule A, is what is used to calculate the itemized deductions, and there is a basic category that hasn't changed significantly other than the elimination of the miscellaneous 2%. So we have health deductions, medical deductions, we have taxes, state and local taxes, property taxes are in another category. Mortgage interest is in still another, charitable contributions, casualty losses, and then there are a few miscellaneous non-2% items that still exist. And that kind of walks you down the Schedule A.
Now, how have those deductions changed with the new tax regulations?
The biggest change, or there are two things that have significantly changed. The elimination of the miscellaneous 2% items, which involves the employee business expense, which is kind of the biggest category in that. For your people who incur expenses to do their job, like the trucker who's gone overnight or anybody in the transportation industry, any salespeople, or anybody who incurs expenses to do their job, those expenses have been eliminated as an itemized deduction. Also in that category would be brokerage commissions or brokerage fees that are paid to, for instance, a broker that is a fee-based broker. Tax preparation fees get into that area. Safety deposit box, you know, a number of investment-type items fit into that category that have been eliminated. Also, the other major item, at least for people in Wisconsin, the other major item is the cap on the tax area. You have been able to deduct either your income tax that was withheld or paid in during the year, or sales tax, whichever is greater, and your property taxes. And your property taxes are on your main home, your second home, real estate that you hold for investment. But all of those numbers together are now capped at $10,000. So that can make a significant difference in the amount of itemized deductions that you come up with.
Has the IRS given a reason or explanation as to why they're making these changes?
Well, the one thing that people have to remember, the IRS is the evil villain just because they're the IRS. But it's not the IRS that makes the tax laws. The IRS may be able to suggest things, but it's Congress. It's your senators and congressmen that are responsible for the changes here. And so without them passing the bill, IRS wouldn't be making any of these changes that are instructed by them.
Mary Mellum of Aswabanen Tax Professionals joins us today. We're talking about the differences between itemized and standard deductions. We're also taking your calls with your tax questions. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Jerry in Tomahawk. Good morning, Jerry. Hello.
Good morning on this beautiful weather day.
Yeah, isn't it wonderful?
Yes. Hey, I do have a question that I'm self-employed for the last 8 years, the sole proprietorship, and basically I have a large deduction every year because of the amount of miles that I travel. And because of that, I don't have to pay in. Because of that large deduction, I'm trying to buy a house, and you know, self-employment is not a good way of buying a house, according to a bank. And I'm wondering if I use less deductions this year in order to make my income look larger, would that be a red flag to the IRS?
Well, Jerry, number one, if the deductions that you have incurred are proper deductions, the IRS expects you to take those deductions. Otherwise, you're artificially creating an income that's not a true income. And I think in some cases, that would not be the right thing to do. Some years ago, back in the 50s, the IRS, there was a court case that an individual did not take all the deductions that they were eligible for and created more income in order to get things like earned income credit or different credits. And they lost in court because you can't artificially manipulate for some other purpose. And I think that's what you would be doing there.
Jerry, thank you so much for the call. Mac in Dunn County sent us an email. It says, I am retired but received a W-2 from my employer for a health incentive payment. I reported the income, small, $150, on my 2018 taxes. However, the W-2 also noted a small amount of uncollected Social Security and Medicare tax associated with this income. I could not determine whether and how I should pay the payroll tax. I have no other FICA obligation for 2018. What should he do?
If he is preparing it himself, there is a way to pay taxes on it. It comes back through the tax section of the tax return. There is a certain line for it that he would be paying it through his normal tax return. So he would be filing a tax return, including the $150 as income, with any other income that he'd have. And there is a special calculation for his share of the FICA and Medicare tax on that $150.
I hope that answers your question, Mac. Thank you so much for the email. Mary, what is the easiest way to decide if you would be better off with the standard or itemized deduction?
Well, the easiest way to do it is to go through the mechanics of doing the Schedule A. And then you're going to compare the answer that you get with the Schedule A to whatever your proper standard deduction is based on your filing status. Now, there's a lot of people that are going to say, based on last year, I itemized last year. For instance, last year's joint filer had a standard deduction of $12,700. And if they were able to itemize because they came up with $13,000, and they compare that $13,000 to the $24,000, it's kind of a no-brainer that the $24,000 is better than the $13,000 that they used last year. And that's what you would be doing. But the one thing that I would caution people about, especially in the state of Wisconsin, there are certain items that are part of that itemized deductions that you still need to pay attention to because they have implications on Wisconsin. So you may not need them for federal purposes, but Wisconsin has an itemized deduction credit that uses the medical, the mortgage interest, and the charity to determine the credits on Wisconsin. And also, your health insurance is a deduction on Wisconsin. So there are things that you need to gather, even if you're not going to use itemized deductions for federal purposes.
What are some of the basic guidelines for taking the standard deduction?
Everyone is allowed a standard deduction. There really isn't a guideline for it, with the exception of a couple who are filing married filing separate. If someone chooses not to file jointly, a married couple, or perhaps they're in the middle of a divorce, they may decide not to file with the other person. There is a rule that says if one of the people in a married separate situation files, itemizes, the other one must, even if their itemized deductions come below the standard. So generally, you have the choice, but in certain circumstances that I mentioned, you don't have that choice.
Let's go back to the emails. Lisa emailed, "I get a W-2 for my part-time job. I also freelance and receive 1099s. I did a job this year for a breast cancer fundraiser, and they dissolved before the event. They asked me if I would not bill them. Can I take what would have been billed as a deduction? Would it be a loss on my Schedule C or a donation in my itemized Fed form? The charge for this job would have been $1,200. What should Lisa do in that situation?
Okay. That's a great question from Lisa. The miscellaneous, the income that you would have received if you are on a cash basis, meaning that you pick up the money as you receive it, is not a deduction because you have never paid taxes on it. But what Lisa can do if she's not going to collect and it's going to be a charitable event for her, she could use the expenses that she incurred out of her pocket to do that activity as a charitable contribution if it is a recognized charity. So if Lisa had to travel there, for instance, or if she had flyers that she incurred to hand out or something that it cost her to do whatever this event was, that could be a charitable contribution for that, but the loss of the income is not a deductible expense.
Mary Mellum, she is an enrolled agent of Eschwaben and Tax Professionals. Her and her husband David have been in the tax business for more than 30 years, serving individuals, consulting to tax professionals, and teaching tax seminars around the country. She joins us today. Darrell Conner filling in today for Larry Mueller. We are asking, what method of deductions are right for you, standard or itemized deductions? What questions do you have about the new tax laws? Or if you have a tax question for Mary, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. More coming up next right here on the Ideas Network. Mary Mellum of Eschwaben and Tax Professionals joins us. Darrell Conner filling in today for Larry Mueller. Good to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. We are talking about itemized deductions versus standard deductions and taking your calls and answering your tax questions. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. An email from Dave from Hurley. He says, "My wife at the my at the time wife filed for bankruptcy in 2017. Today I received a 1099-A in the mail. What do I have to do? How could it change the amount I owe or have to pay in? What should Dave do, Mary?"
Well, the 1099-A is an abandonment form. And it means that there is a sale of whatever property is listed on that 1099-A. So in his circumstances, I'm assuming that there was some joint property that may have been sold as a result of the bankruptcy or sold as a result of any of this. And so that, depending on what kind of property it is, he is going to have to report that sale. And the 1099-A, he'd have to look at it. Presumably it's for his share of it, although if it's joint property, the issuer of it might have issued the whole price to each one of the people. But it would be the sale of the item that is disclosed in the description section of the 1099-A.
Let's go to the phones. And thank you, Dave from Hurley, for the email. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Diana in Sun Prairie. Good morning, Diana. Hello.
Good morning.
Did you have a question for Mary?
Yes, I do. It's quite lengthy.
That's okay.
Okay. I'm just going to use Andy as a 58-year-old husband, has a family high-deductible health plan through his work. He is putting money in his HSA to pay for medical expenses. His wife is 66 years old, covered by his family high deductible health plan. She is also getting Part A Medicare because she's 66 years old, and to get your Social Security payments, you have to take Part A Medicare. Can Andy put $8,000 per year in his HSA because it's his family high deductible health plan, or can he only put in for just himself, even though he's responsible for all medical bills?
First of all, the $8,000 is too high a number for the maximum for a family plan. The maximum for a family plan, I believe, is $6,950 for this year. For 18, it was $6,900, and you are still able to put the money in for 18 if that's it. And for 19, it might be slightly higher, but I know it's not $8,000. Now, the next part of it is, who is covered by his high deductible medical plan? If he is paying for a family plan, then it is the $69 for 18. If he is only paying for single coverage, then it's $34.50 for the 2018 number. So you have to look at the medical plan, the coverage under it.
Diana, thank you so much for the call. Mary, we had a listener that called in and couldn't stay on the line, but she was wondering, if I live in Wisconsin but work in Minnesota, what are my obligations for filing taxes?
That's a good question. If someone, years ago, we would have said that Wisconsin and Minnesota have reciprocity with regard to employment, which meant that you didn't have to pay Minnesota tax on the income that you earned in Minnesota. The residents got to count it for Wisconsin. That reciprocity went away a few years ago. So what she will have to do is pay taxes to Minnesota, file a Minnesota non-resident return, pay taxes to Minnesota, file a Wisconsin return, include that income in the Wisconsin return, and fill out the Wisconsin OS, which is a Wisconsin credit for taxes paid to the other state.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The listener who called in, we didn't get the name, but thank you so much for the email. Mary, can we go back? We talked about itemized versus standard deductions. What are some of the expenses you can use when you itemize?
For the majority of the people, the categories of itemized deductions that we see most often are the taxes, the mortgage interest, and the charity. Those are the three most often used. Medical is possible, but medical has a 10% floor for it, 7.5% for 2018. It changes to 10% in 2019. Sometimes it's difficult to get over that 7.5% if you've had a bad medical year or you're paying your own medical insurance after tax, then it will be a situation for that person. But most often, property taxes, mortgage interest, and charity are the three that are the most common types that we see this year.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Richard in Washburn. Good morning, Richard. Hello.
Hello.
Did you have a question for Mary?
Yes. I'm 86 years old. We have no interest expense for mortgages or car payments or whatever. Our property taxes are approximately $2,000 a year. I would guess I automatically would qualify for standard deduction.
What kind of income? And yes, you would qualify for a standard deduction as anyone would. If you're single, you also get an extra $1,600 to add to that $12,000. If you're married and your spouse is also over 65, your standard deduction would go up to $26,600. And as long as your income is less than that, chances are you're not going to incur any income taxes.
Richard, thank you so much for the call. We received an email from Ruth Ann. She says, I am working on taxes and have for the past years always filed capital gains losses on a mutual fund for my granddaughter. We sold it this past summer, and I will be paying tax on it. However, my granddaughter's Social Security number is on the form. Anything I need special as I file under my Social Security number as the owner? Thank you for the information.
All right. First of all, I'm assuming that this possibly is something that an account that was set up for her granddaughter. Generally, if a grandparent sets up an account under a uniform transfer to minors account, that account is listed in the child's Social Security number, and the income that that account generates is taxable income to the granddaughter. Now, many times it's low enough that the child doesn't have to file the form. Any capital gains from the sale of that also belong to the granddaughter. They are not income to the grandmother. There is a special rule for parents that allows the parents in certain cases to include the income from interest, dividends, and capital gain distributions on the parents' return. It's the concept of kiddie tax that comes into it, but that does not include the grandparent. And even in the sale of the asset, that form doesn't work for that. So the child would have to report it if it's a large enough transaction to cause the child to have to file.
Thank you for the email, Ruth Ann. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City. Christina, good morning.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm calling regarding a form that I received. It's a 1099-G, So it's 2018. In 2016, we had somebody prepare our taxes, and according to the IRS, they never did receive that information. So we resubmitted it, and we received a refund of $2,582 after the interest and late fees that we paid. According to this form, we have the impression that they're suggesting this refund would be considered 2018 income. What are your thoughts on that?
All right. Is it from the state that you're getting this 1099-G?
Yes, it's Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
Okay. The state refund may be taxable depending on whether you itemized and claim state taxes, but you will receive a 1099-G when a refund is given in a certain year. So when you did this, you must have received the money in 2018 during that year, even if it was from a prior year's return. And that's why it's coming through, because it's a 2018 receipt. And so the question is, did you itemize in a year and get benefit from the tax that was paid, and that's what would create it, cause it to be taxable in this year.
Christina, thank you so much for the call. We are talking itemized versus standard deductions. We're also taking your questions about taxes with Mary Mellum. She's from Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Mary and her husband David have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. Mary is an enrolled agent. She serves individuals, consults to tax professionals, and she teaches tax seminars around the country. We are taking your calls. What questions do you have about the new tax laws? Are you wondering which method of deductions are right for you? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Ted in West Dallas. Good morning, Ted. Hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. How are you?
Good. I've got a question that maybe might help a lot of maybe newly retired seniors. And the question really comes down to is there a minimal amount of money that you need to have generated throughout the year to have to even file taxes? For example, in my case, I retired the first of 2017, but I didn't collect Social Security until the middle of the year because that's when I turned 66. So my statement from the Social Security is indicating just over $10,000 in income from them, and from my employer, it's about $5,000. And I'm wondering if I even need to worry about filing taxes, and is there like a minimal amount that you have to make throughout the year to do so?
That's a good question, Ted. As far as the standard deductions that we've been talking about, that is the gross income that gives you the idea of where your filing requirement is. So if you are single, you can make up to $12,000 without having to file a tax return. And that's not to say you might not want to file it for another reason, but you wouldn't be required to. In the scenario that you gave, the Social Security, it's only the taxable portion of the Social Security plus your wages that goes to determine whether you've met the filing requirement. So if the 15 that you described is all that you have, you would be under the $12,000 filing requirement because the Social Security at that level would not be taxable.
Ted, thank you so much for the call. Doreen sent us an email. It says, in the past, we were able to deduct mortgage interest on a home equity line of credit, but I believe that changed with the new tax law, and now you can only deduct that interest if it was actually used for home improvements, etc. Part of that credit line was used for such purposes, but the funds have been used for other reasons as well. We can't deduct it at all then, can we?
That's an excellent question. One of the things with itemized deductions so far that we haven't touched on yet is what happened to mortgage interest. And mortgage interest to buy, build, or substantially renovate your home is totally deductible. The change in the law took away the home equity interest deduction for things other than home improvements or to purchase the home. So, yes, what she asked is correct. You cannot deduct that much of the interest that is allocable to something other than buy, build, or renovate the house. The tricky part is when you have a mixed-use loan, you have to determine in this particular year how much of the proceeds were used to buy the house or to build or renovate the house and how much were used for other things. That percentage of the other things is not allowed. IRS also this year put on the Schedule A new box that asks the filer, is this loan a mixed-use loan? And you need to check that box if it is, and you're kind of juggling the numbers, so to speak. So it's a little bit of a tricky calculation, especially if you have done this sometime in the past. There is something called the tracing rules, and there is a certain level of identifying which of the debts goes away. Ultimately, as the debt goes along, if you've had a mixed-use loan and part of it is the home, that might survive to be 100% deductible somewhere in the future. But it's a little bit of a confusing concept.
Thank you so much for the email. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Dennis in Stoughton. Good morning, Dennis. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm single, and I get $24,000 in Social Security disability per year. Plus, I also take $10,000 from a rolled-over retirement account that's in a CD. With property taxes at $4,300 per year, I guess my question is, do I have to file taxes? And would it be beneficial to file even if I wasn't required to?
First of all, I believe, just looking at the numbers, that some part of your Social Security may be taxable. You're kind of on that cusp of it. And so I would say you would be required to file a tax return because your $10,000 certainly doesn't get you over the requirement, but the amount of the Social Security that is taxable, that one may get you over that. So I would say the answer to be yes, even though you're close. The $4,300 of property tax in the federal return is not going to make a difference because it's not enough to itemize. On the state return, you would not have to pay any taxes because Wisconsin does not tax Social Security. So your standard deduction for state would be enough to wipe out your $10,000. The only other way to look at it is the homestead credit. And the homestead credit has a total income number of just under $25,000 in order to get a homestead credit. But the Social Security for homestead purpose is totally taken into consideration. So you would not qualify for homestead credit based on the scenario that you've given me.
Dennis, thank you so much for the call. A listener emailed in about EdVest dollars. They ask, if our grandson does not go on to school, what are the tax consequences of taking his EdVest funds? I understand he has to pay a 10% penalty. Is that on the earnings or principal or both? Does he have to pay tax on the total amount or only the earnings?
That's a good question. The EdVest, if it is used for things other than education, it is the earnings that become taxable and subject to the 10% penalty. But I would also suggest that if the grandparents are the ones that put the money into the account, they would be, if there are other grandchildren, they would be able to roll that money from one child to another without losing the tax benefits of it. But if the grandson who is not going to college is able to take the money out and not use it for education, it is the earnings that are taxable and subject to the 10% penalty.
Thank you so much for the email. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Rich in West Bend. Good morning, Rich. Hello.
Good morning to you, and thank you for taking my call. I would like to follow up question to many of the questions your listeners have asked. How can I estimate the amount of Social Security income that is taxable? I'm retired, and I'm not working at all. Is there a formula or a percentage that I can estimate how much of my Social Security income is taxable?
Yes, there is. The IRS has a worksheet that you can use for Social Security taxability purposes. And basically, the formula goes like adding all of your taxable income plus one half of your Social Security, and that total compares to the IRS's the numbers, a level. There is a certain level for the single person and a level for the married couple. And the best way to get that worksheet would be to go to the IRS website and type in Social Security taxability in the website, and you would come up with that that Social Security number.
Thank you so much for the call, Rich. Dwayne sent us an email. He asked, is it possible and safe to give rent credit to a family member for work done on the property? Would I lose ability to take depreciation? Someone said it's okay as long as there wasn't a net loss. I want to lend a hand to a young family member. Thanks so much.
I'm not exactly sure what he's asking as far as rent credit, so I'm going to kind of guess at the answer to, or guess at what his question is. If rent credit means the credit that that person gets to take for having paid rent on their Wisconsin return, because Wisconsin does give a credit based on the rent you paid, if he's saying, can I give them, say that they've paid me money when they didn't, obviously that's not the right thing. So I'm guessing that's what he's talking about, but I'm not sure, you know, if that's exactly what he means by giving a rent credit. Otherwise, the credit is given by the state of Wisconsin based on the amount of the rent that is paid.
Thank you for the email, Dwayne. We are talking about standard or itemized deductions, which one is appropriate for you. We're also taking your calls regarding the new tax laws. Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals is with us. She is an enrolled agent. Her and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years, serving individuals, consulting to tax professionals, and teaching tax seminars around the country. Do you have questions about the changes in tax regulations? Are you wondering which deduction method works for you? Do you have a tax question for Mary? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Darrell Conner filling in today for Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau is the producer. On-air production is Jane Rotunda, and David Potranz is the board operator. We'll continue with more right here on the Ideas Network. We are talking taxes with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She is with us today. Darrell Conner filling in for Larry Mueller today. Give us a call if you have any questions about the new changes in tax regulations, if you're wondering which deduction method works for you. What concerns do you have about taxes? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the emails. Let's go. Mary emailed, is a settlement from a motor vehicle accident taxable?
Generally, the answer to that is no. That if you have an accident and the settlement involves paying for your vehicle, restoring your vehicle. That's just making you whole. If the settlement is because of physical injury, again, generally, that's not a taxable event. About the only thing that would be taxable is if the settlement included what we call punitive damages. Punitive damages would be damages that are like a slap on the hand of the person who caused the problem. So punitive damages would be the part in the settlement that would be taxable. Otherwise, personal injury settlements or a restoration of what you've lost is not a taxable event in that case.
Thank you for the email. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Saeed in Fond du Lac. Good morning, Saeed. Welcome.
Good morning. Mary, you mentioned earlier that for married filing jointly, so standard deduction would be over $24,000 if both of them or one of them are older than 65 or 66 years. Is there any income limit to that?
No, there's no income limit to it. For each person in a married couple that is over 65, there is an additional $1,300 that increases your standard deduction. And a standard deduction is allowable regardless of your income level. There isn't a phase out of the standard deduction as you increase your income.
Saeed, thank you so much for the call. Rick sent us an email. He asked, would Mary comment on the loss of the personal exemptions when discussing the changes to the deductions in the tax law?
I certainly would. This year, as you're looking at the new tax form, which there is a new tax form out there that is very interesting if you haven't seen it yet, you will notice that different from last year where we had a line to deduct a personal exemption, and last year's personal exemption was $4,050 per taxpayer, spouse, and all dependent children or dependents on that tax return. In creating the new tax law, the $4,000 exemption, or $4,050 last year, is completely gone. Now, the trade-off is kind of twofold. The standard deduction increased very generously, and for some people, the loss of the personal exemption, together with the increase in the standard deduction, may balance out to some extent where they're at. The more personal exemptions you have, the more the difference or the dissension between the two. The increased standard deduction is not going to make up for the loss of the personal exemptions, which means taxpayers are going to come out with a higher income subject to tax. The tax rates have gone down, so that's going to buffer for some people. And also, if the dependents are children, the child tax credit for the child under the age of 17 has doubled from $1,000 to $2,000. So that certainly helps offset that loss of personal exemption. And for other dependents on the return that are over the age, are 17 or over, there is a $500 credit that didn't exist before that, again, kind of helps to buffer the loss of those personal exemptions.
Thanks so much for the email, Rick. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Kate in Milwaukee. Good morning, Kate. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. There's been a lot of information in the news lately about how the refunds are lower. And I'm just wondering if you could address that, because it seems that the withholding gave people back more money per paycheck, and so their refunds would naturally be lower. But I don't think people quite understand that, and that if they wanted a larger refund, they should lower their withholding. So could you talk to that a little bit, just to clear up some of the misinformation that's in the news?
Sure. I think that's a great idea, Kate. The IRS, when the new tax law came out, the IRS was, and that happened back in February, the IRS was directed to redo the withholding tables so less was paid out, was taken out of a check, and thus less available. If you are looking at your refund from last year and comparing it to the refund from this year, and the income is exactly the same, the tax probably will have gone down. But also, the withholding, because the change of the withholding tables, the withholding has gone down also. So even though you're benefiting from the tax law change, there isn't as much there to pay it. So you're going to get back what you have, but it's in two pieces. You got some of it during the year that you may or may not have even noticed, and then whatever happens on the tax return. IRS has, throughout the year, has a public service campaign every year and different topics. This year's topic, if you happen to hear those, was to warn people to make sure that you check your withholding and see how it is different from what it was last year. IRS knew that this was going to happen, and some people heeded the advice and are very happy with what the result of their tax returns are, and others are not, just because they weren't looking ahead that this reduced withholding was going to affect the end of the year.
Kate, thank you so much for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Liz in Kenosha. Good morning, Liz. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a public school music teacher, and I also do private teaching on the side. In the past, I have made as much as $6,000 annually, and so I do file Schedule C and also SE so I can pay Social Security on my income. This past year, my income did decrease quite a bit, and I'm now roughly, I only made about $1,500 this year, and I have less expenses, and so I'm wondering if I should even, if I still have to file Schedule C, even though I'm pretty sure I have to do SE so that I pay Social Security on my income.
Liz, that's an excellent question. Your Schedule C, if you are in the business of teaching lessons as opposed to making it a hobby, the Schedule C is the place that you have to file it. And anytime you have over $400 of earnings, roughly, that are self-employment, it is subject to SE tax. So I would suggest that you continue doing it the way that you have been doing. But I do have one little sunshine spot for you, that because the tax law, or involved with the tax law, is a special deduction that is called a QBI deduction. So people who are self-employed, because the corporate tax rates on C corporations went down, the tax writing community decided to create a deduction for other businesses that are not C corporations to kind of even the playing field. And so people who have Schedule Cs that are positive with U.S. income are going to get a corresponding QBI deduction. It's about 20%. It's not as simple necessarily as just multiplying the positive income by 20%, but that's kind of the concept. So even though you have self-employment tax and income on it, you may be finding it not to be as hurtful as it has been in the past because of the QBI deduction.
Thank you so much for the call, Liz. Anders sent us an email. He said, my parents purchased the common stock shares from me when I was a child roughly 30 years ago. In case the basis information, i.e. purchase price of these shares, how does that affect my tax return if I sell the shares?
Did I understand that he knows the basis?
It doesn't say.
Okay. Then a basis is the cost of those shares. The sale of the stock at a certain price minus the cost basis equals the gain that would result and be taxed at that point. So buying it years ago, probably if it's a good stock, means that the cost basis of the stock was much lower than it is now. So that's going to result in a gain, and depending on his income level, the gain may be 0% taxable, 15% taxable, or 20% taxable.
Mary Mellum of Aswabinen Tax Professionals. She is back with us. She's an enrolled agent. Mary and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years, serving individuals, consulting the tax professionals, and teaching tax seminars around the country. We're talking about itemized versus standard deductions, but we're also taking your tax questions. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Darrell Conner filling in for Larry Mueller today. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Discussing whether standard or itemized deductions is appropriate for you when preparing your taxes, and we're also taking your calls and emails regarding the new tax laws. This is Darrell Conner filling in for Larry Mueller today. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Mary Mellum of Aswabinen Tax Professionals is back with us. She's an enrolled agent. Mary and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years, serving individuals, consulting to tax professionals, and teaching tax seminars around the country. Do you have questions about the new changes in tax regulations? Are you wondering which deduction method works for you? What concerns do you have about taxes? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's get back to the phones. Let's go to Keith in Triple I. Keith, welcome.
Hi. One of my questions got answered. It was about the child tax credits. And my son just turned 17, and it dropped to $500. Was that something new, or is that something that's been out there for a while?
Keith, thank you so much for the call. Mary, did that change this year?
Yes. In the past, the child tax credit stopped, which it used to be $1,000, stopped when the child reached age 17, and there was nothing beyond that as far as a child tax credit. The $500 is new for this year, and it is for a child who has reached the age of 17 by the end of the year, or for anyone else that you would be having as your dependent, such as a parent that might be your dependent. So anyone that is in the dependent line on the tax return either qualifies because they're a qualifying child under the age of 17 for the $2,000 credit or qualifies for the $500 credit. Keep in mind that there is an income limitation where the credit will phase out, but the income limitation is much higher than it has in the past. So the $500 credit is a new credit available. The $2,000, which used to be the $1,000 credit, is available, and now it will be available to people who in the past made too much money to get that credit. So if you didn't get the child tax credit in the past and you see it coming up on your tax return, it's because of the expanded income levels that allow them to claim the credit.
Keith, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Beverly in Cedarburg. Good morning, Beverly. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a question. Earlier in the program, Mary was discussing with the deductions whether to oppose to itemizing or not to. And you had said something about go ahead and send everything anyway because of the Wisconsin tax laws. Did I get that right?
That is correct. For some income levels, you're able to, if your deductions are greater than the standard deduction on the Wisconsin return, there is a 5% credit on the excess allowable deductions for Wisconsin. Wisconsin needs to see those. So what happens on the tax return is there is a Schedule A prepared for state purposes only, and that's how they gather those deductions onto the Wisconsin return.
Thank you for the call, Beverly. We have an email from Brian. He says, I have two scenarios comparing 2018 tax year to 2019 tax year. I just retired effective end of January 2019. With that, our joint income will go down significantly in 2019. This year, rough income is $100,000. Planning to use standard deduction, so tax year 2018. Can we use the standard deduction next year, tax filing 2019, with a significantly lower income, estimating around $40,000? Wouldn't I be receiving a significant amount back tax year 2019 using the standard deduction of $24,000?
The standard deduction is an automatic deduction, except in the case of the married separate individual that I mentioned. How much you get back it, with $100,000 income in 2018, that leaves $76,000 subject to tax. In 2019, it leaves $16,000 subject to tax. And what you get back is going to depend on how much you've paid in to pay those taxes, or if there are other credits that apply in this particular situation. But the standard deduction is available, period, regardless of what your income level is. The itemized deduction option is to give you more to write off against your income if you have the types of expenses that would be eligible, and it comes to a number greater than the $24,000 in the case of a married couple. So I hope that clarifies things.
Thanks for the email, Brian. We'll do one more email before going back to the phones. Tim sent in an email. It says, I received a 1099 miscellaneous from some contract work that I performed. I also sent out a 1099 miscellaneous to several subcontractors for helping with that same job. Do I report what was on my 1099 miscellaneous as income, or do I first subtract what I paid the subcontractors from that amount?
If you are an independent contractor in business, you would be filing a Schedule C. The first thing the Schedule C asks for is gross income. The gross income would be the 1099 that you received, along with any other income that you might have that was not reported on a 1099. Then in the expense section, it asks for the expenses that you incurred in making this income. Your independent contractor payments would be an expense. So you're going to report the income and show the subtraction of the expenses as well as any other expenses that you've incurred in addition to the subcontractors.
Thank you so much for the email, Tim. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Tom in Ashland. Good afternoon, Tom. Hello.
Hi. Thank you, Mary, for all your tax help.
You're welcome.
My question is, I made a charitable contribution in 2016 of $6,000. It seems, when I did 2017 taxes, it seems that I was only able to write off half of that, $3,000, as I recall. I guess the question is, can I carry that deduction into 2018 taxes?
Okay. First of all, I think, I'm not sure if I got the years right, but I think you said you made it in 2016. Was I correct, Matt? Okay. In 2016, if your income is low enough, your deduction is limited to 50% of your income. So if you were only getting a $3,000 deduction, that excess $3,000 that you weren't able to claim that year would be allowed to be claimed for the next 5 years. It's available. So then you would go to 17 and add that to your deductions for that year, and the limit of 50% would apply for 2017. If there was anything left over that was not able to be deducted in that year, yes, it would carry to 2018.
Thank you for the call, Tom. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Kristen in Bailey's Harbor. Good afternoon, Kristen. Hello.
Hi. My question today is based on I own a small business, and I get a tax deduction every year if I make a contribution to an IRA. Now, to me, as a small business owner, I feel like I'm investing, when I do that, in somebody else's business, not my own, for one. And number two, I feel like I'm getting a tax deduction to basically gamble, because as an example, this year, my $7,000 deduction was a complete loss. So where does that tax deduction come from historically, and how does it really benefit small business?
Okay, I'm not sure I'm gathering exactly what you mean. So let me kind of go through this. If you have a small business and you have a positive income from that small business, and that's all you have, you are allowed as a small business owner either to have a retirement plan for yourself called an IRA, or there are things like SEPs and SIMPLES that also are available to business owners. That deduction that you put into an account in your own name is deductible as an adjustment to income, not on the Schedule C where the small business income is. But its purpose is to allow a self-employed person to have a retirement available to them, just like an employee whose employer has a retirement fund that they or the employer are able to contribute to. So again, it's trying to make the small business available to some of the benefits that one might see that an employee or a large business has. Now, I don't know if that answers your question. I'm not exactly sure about what you meant by investing in somebody else's business.
Well, when I make a contribution to an IRA, it basically goes, that money goes towards somebody else's business to generate money that will be put, go ahead.
The IRA that you're putting away is at your discretion to where it goes. It might be to a bank, that it sits in the bank and generates interest income, and it's all your money. If you mean the bank is making more money out of it, that's what banks do. If you choose to invest in other types of investments like buying stocks or mutual funds, your money is going to invest in that, but in the end, it's your money. And if you put that money in and it didn't do well this year, it could be a consequence of the situation or a place that you chose to invest it.
Kristen, thank you so much for the call. Mary Mellum of Aswabinan Tax Professionals is with us answering your tax questions. Let's grab another email. Sue sent us an email and says, last fall, our family sold land that my dad had left us. I am wondering about capital gains taxes. Can you tell me what I will need to file income taxes for this gain? I have the appraisal that was done 24 years ago. Cost of sale and transfer, as well as real estate taxes paid from the profits, and of course have received a 1099. We are both retired, so I'm wondering if this gain will be taxable. Can you help? Thanks so much.
Sue did a great job of telling us what she had, which helps a lot. The 1099-S that she has is the sale price of the land. I'm assuming that if she owned it jointly with someone, it's her share of it. the 24-year-old appraisal is helpful because if the father died 24 years ago, the cost basis of that land was determined on his date of death, and that's what the appraisal will give. And so the amount of the sale proceeds that belong to her minus her share of the cost or the fair market value at the date of death plus any closing costs that incurred, the appraisal cost or the fair market value at the date of death plus any closing costs, that sum compared to what she received, the difference, is going to be the taxable event to her. Now, this is long-term, so the long-term capital gain rates apply. And so if she has income that is basically in the 10 or 12%, her capital gain rate would be zero. If her income is higher, it could be 15% of that gain. Or if she has a very high income or what I would say is a good income, it could be possibly up to 20%. But I would say that the 15% rate is where most people fall in.
Thank you for the email, Sue. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Paul in Onalaska. Good afternoon, Paul. Hello.
Hello. My question is this. I became a widower on December 1st of 2018, and I'd like to know how that might affect the standard deduction for 2018, and we always filed jointly.
That's a good question. I'm sorry for your loss, first of all. And for 2018, your tax return is going to look very similar to what it did in 2017. If you file jointly in 2017, 2018 would normally be a joint return to look just like that. And the standard deduction would be the joint filing standard deduction. Now, do you have any dependent children that live with you?
No.
Okay. The reason I ask that is a qualifying widower that has dependent children will also get the married joint standard deduction for two more years. In your case, the next year, 2019, your standard deduction will go as a single person unless you would choose to get married before the end of the year.
Paul, thank you so much for the call, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Let's grab another email. Christy emailed, can Mary please explain earned income credit and head of household and who qualifies?
Okay. Earned income credit is a credit, and it is a credit for people who work that have income within a certain limit. That credit, there's three different areas of it. There is a credit for the person who has no children. There is a credit for the person who has one child or two or more children. And the earned income credit, it's kind of like a hill, that as your income, earned income, you have to work in order to qualify, your earned income goes up, your credit increases. Once you reach the top of the mountain, so to speak, then the credit starts decreasing as you make more money. The idea is to help someone who has a lower income to encourage them to work more to get a higher credit, and as they get on their feet, they don't need the government subsidy as bad, and it goes down as they make more money. That's the concept behind it. The head of household status is another status that says for a person who is single and provides a home for more than half the year for a dependent child, they get an extra standard deduction, something between the single person and the married couple. So the key to head of household is that you have to pay more than half the cost of maintaining a home that is the home of you and a dependent child. That's the general rule for that. Earned income credit is a credit that is available most often to people with children who have lower incomes, but it also is available to a single person whose income is low. They may also qualify for the credit.
Thank you so much for the email. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Dennis in Brookfield. Dennis, good afternoon. Hello.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I have questions about Schedule D, as in Dennis, capital gains.
Yep.
I have struggled with the second page of Schedule D and then the tax worksheet for years. The tax worksheet is 45 questions and answers, and it's extremely complicated. Was this document looked at again, or is it the same document that was in 2017?
The tax bill really did not have anything to do with a change in the calculation of the Schedule D. Can you be more specific about what the nature of your problem with the Schedule D is, or what was leading you to use that?
Well, I have capital gains from investments.
Okay.
I've filed Schedule D for 15 years.
Okay. The Schedule D has changed over the years, because on the Schedule D in the years back, the calculations were done right on the Schedule D form. A few years ago, the IRS created a form 8949, and the 8949 basically lists the sales. And they did this somewhere near the time where they required brokerages to keep track of basis for people. And so the 8949 is the form that you would be reporting the gross selling price and the cost basis and determining the gain and whether it's short-term or long-term. And then on the Schedule D, you get to the placing those things. And I guess maybe the part that I'm thinking that you might be struggling with is the calculation of whether you fall in the 0% bracket or the 15% bracket. And all I can say is that, to my knowledge, they have not adjusted the worksheet there or the lines on that form.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us today. Sorry we ran out of time. Tomorrow at 11, we'll be talking about new paddling products and owl vocalizations. Hope you can join us right here at 11.
Let's go through this one more time.
My name is Peter B. Parker. For the last 22 years, I thought I was the one and only Spider-Man.
I'm Joshua Johnson, the producer, writer, and director of the Oscar-nominated Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Next time on 1A. Join me this afternoon at 1 here on the Ideas Network.